ladies and gentlemen, we present at this time the regular Sunday afternoon program of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan.
Ladies and gentlemen, Father Coughlin is deeply grateful to the many thousands of persons who were responsible for filling his office with mail. The first reprinting of Father Fahey's book, Rulers of Russia, has been exhausted. A second printing, double that of the first, has been ordered and will be distributed as soon as possible, together with a copy of last week's discourse and of today's discourse. Needless to say, we were happy to learn of Father Coughlin's courageous stand taken last Sunday. Today, fortified with brilliant quotations, it will be his privilege to address this audience on the subject, Discussing a Christian Front, that all may know the truth about Christian democracy and the necessity of incorporating its principles in this nation. By the end of this week, another 150,000 copies of last week's address and the valuable book, The Rulers of Russia, will be available. If you desire to possess a copy and know the documented truth, write this week to Father Coughlin at Royal Oak, Michigan. It will be his pleasure to mail you these items. And also for your information, we are glad to announce that the circulation of Social Justice magazine has increased by about 100,000 copies this past week alone. And now, ladies and gentlemen, your spokesman, Father Coughlin.
Ladies and gentlemen and friends, last week it was reported that Mr. John L. Lewis, chieftain of the CIO, voiced his dramatic disapproval of the New Deal. As important as this news may be, it was not half so astounding as was the tumultuous silence on the part of the press relative to the plot disclosed to overthrow the government of the United States of America. Reiterating that the Department of Justice, operating under the direction of the Honorable Frank Murphy and J. Edgar Hoover, were careful to avoid implicating the Christian Front in this alleged sedition, and reemphasizing that most of the disparaging allegations heaped upon that group originated with a portion of the press of America, the general public might have reason to wonder why news of such a startling nature did not rake conspicuous space in last week's columns of these same papers. It is hoped that this telltale omission on the part of those journals, which collaborated in headlining so many damaging inaccuracies, will not be linked to the Moscow-directed strategy of smear and run. Although the idea of a Christian Front certainly was never invented by me, although in one sense it is traceable to the hillsides of Palestine and to the upper room in Jerusalem, where the resurrected Christ addressed his followers, praying that they be one and commissioning them to act officially in his name, there seems to be current the idea that social America can survive without a Christian Front, that we can achieve prosperity and happiness without adopting the principles and morals taught by the crucified Christ to direct not only our individual personal lives, but also the policies which should find expression in our social, public lives. I mean government, education, industry, counting houses, and homes. Refusal. Official and political refusal to accept Christ's social doctrines. Incorporating them in our public and semi-public institutions is one of the major tragedies of our time. Christianity is confined neither by the limitations of race nor by the restrictions of nationality. It was not intended to be the religion of the Latin and Celtic races only. Oh, like the noonday sun, it was intended by Christ, the King of mankind, to shine upon all the children of men. Did he not say, "Go ye therefore, teaching all nations"? And did not this command impose upon the nations the duty of accepting the King's message? In one sense, my friends, the Christian religion is a philosophy not only for the individual, but also for society as a whole, Christ's philosophy. And in another sense, it is a concrete organization established by the supreme authority. An organization which all men are dutifully invited to join. An organization of which he is the invisible head. An organization for which he provided a visible head to rule and to teach in his name. At one and the same time, therefore, the organization of the Christian Church is divine and human. Divine in its origin, in its authority, and in its end. And human in its visible head and membership. Its purpose for existence is definite. It was established neither to compete with nor to overturn the kingdoms or republics of this world, and in their stead set up new monarchs, new parliaments, and new congresses. Rather, the organization of the church was designed to enable individuals to attain that ultimate happiness which is denied them upon earth, and to renovate and purify a decadent society through its doctrines and their practice, to the end that peace with its attendant blessings will be realized. In a word, the organization established by Christ strives that liberty, prosperity, and culture will replace the unutterable tyranny, the abysmal poverty, and the crude vices and ignorance which were manifest before the advent of Christianity. Evils which are rapidly reappearing in our day because many citizens and governments have definitely refuse to acknowledge Christ as King and his religion as the world's Magna Carta, its Declaration of Independence, and Divine Constitution all in one. There then, my friend, is the basic idea of a Christian front. An idea not to be confused, as I have warned and do warn again, with any temporal organization operating independent of or contrary to the organization established by the Son of God. And there then is my concept of a Christian front, consisting at one and the same time of a doctrine and of a God Earth-born organization for the salvation, the redemption, and peace of mankind. Thou art Peter or a rock, and upon this rock I will build my church. To thee do I give the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Feed my lambs and feed my sheep. He who heareth me. I will be with thee all days until the consummation of the world. Without me you can do nothing. Upon those and other familiar biblical passages just quoted are established the fundamental idea of the colloquial term Christian Front, which, in its more hallowed terminology, so I can see, is identified with the Christian church. A Christian church not dead but alive in 1,000 sub-organizations closely federated under one jurisdiction. A Christian church not dormant but awake to every vital and moral issue of the day. A Christian church whose members, not subservient but militant, are prepared to fight as true soldiers of Christ. The Christian Front, which I consider to be nothing more than a popular word for the Christian church established by Jesus Christ, is not, unfortunately, the only front which invites the citizens of this nation and of every nation to join its ranks. Definitely there is an anti-Christian front which, at the same time, is anti-God. And there is a non-Christian front which, although professedly is neither anti-Christ nor anti-God, is best described by the words a naturalistic front. The former, the anti-Christ, anti-God front, sometimes is referred to by scholars as the Marxian front. It is positively materialistic. It entertains no idea of the future life or a future happiness. It is openly anti-king and anti-government, having adopted a program of worldwide revolution. It acclaims Barabbas the thief of liberty, of happiness, and of prosperity. It acclaims him as its patron. It is the roaring lion going about the world seeking whom it may devour, roaring on the rostrum, roaring in the press, on the silver screen, in the classroom, in the halls of government, roaring with its purchased propaganda of shallow promises and candy-coated lies to deceive, if possible, even the elect. Chameleon-like, it changes its name and external manifestations from age to age, and will continue to do so until eventually it will appear incarnated in the person of Antichrist himself. More insidious, possibly, than this Marxian front is the naturalistic front. It is associated with the general teaching that man, although recognizing God and Christ, nevertheless can manage to get along without them, particularly in his social life. This particular front is the more insidious, I maintain, possibly because of its advertised tolerance towards Christ and his teachings. And possibly because it lures many persons into its fold through the misuse and abuse of the word democracy, which modernly is regarded by many naturalists not only as a political form of government, but as a new religion. The new ship launched to cargo mankind to the haven of prosperity and peace. Assuredly, no Christian is opposed to democracy in its reasonable interpretation. Gladly do we maintain that it is a form of government designed to safeguard liberty and to better the conditions of the masses. Therefore, do not accuse me of being opposed to the sound, to the accepted principles identified with genuine democracy. Although I do dare protest when the word is employed to engage the popular ear with errors which are most undemocratic. Beware, then, of this insidious naturalism. It advances the theory that religion should be cabined within the four walls of a church, cribbed into a single day of the week, or confined to private devotions whispered within the cloister of a home. It dismisses as impractical the theory that Christ came to establish a new social life for the world, with all its divisions and activity. And finally, it argues that Christianity should have no honored place in government, no final voice in law, no acknowledged dominance in domestic affairs, and no established textbook in school. It is the voice of a sickly child impertinently saying to his father, "You are my parent, I confess, but away with you and your physician and nurse and tutor. I can provide for myself." Man, the measure of all things, is also one of the fundamental preachments of the naturalistic front. Yes, puny man, emerging from the slime of the prehistoric marshes, congregating in his tribes, building his nations, tyrannizing his fellow citizens, rising to a momentary power, and sinking to political, economic, and spiritual slavery. All puny man may have produced an Aristotle, a Demosthenes, a Virgil, or an Augustus. But to recollect, my friends, that the doctrine of man, the measure of all things, also produced the paganism of the Greeks, the imperialism of the Romans, and the moral, physical, intellectual, and economic degradation of the 20th century, whose chief occupation appears to be that of war and conquest. Pause, therefore, to inquire, why did Christ come into the world? Your penny catechism tells you why. To redeem and save us, of course. To supply a crutch for the spiritually lame, a light for the intellectually blind, to insist that man is not the measure of all things, to prove that God is the measure of all things, and to establish a standard of truth and morals among the nations, bidding them to seek forth the kingdom of God and his justice, not man's justice, and all things else will be added unto them. Therefore, with this conception of the A Christian Front, I speak the following. Any concentrated attack, no matter how artfully disguised on this concept of a Christian Front, which I now interpret and have interpreted in the popular language of the day as representing the Christian Church, is an attack on Christianity. The Marxian Front existing in America is very apparent. Its followers, however, though pampered by millions of fellow travelers, and its flag, though recognized by our government, are in disrepute. No wonder its sympathizers are in desperation. The naturalistic front, not so apparent, because it lies behind the silken veil of unctuous words, instead of recognizing the Christian religion as the essential and most vital element for the salvation of individuals and the regeneration of society, instead of insisting upon Christianizing every phase of life, and instead of accepting Christ as the measure of all things, this naturalistic front, makes man, I repeat, the measure of all things and views democracy without religion as more important than religion itself. That's a startling statement. And here is an example of what I mean. In a widely publicized address delivered at Yeshiva College, New York City, December 11, 1937, the Honorable Frank Murphy, now an associate judge on the bench of the Supreme Court, indicated, unconsciously, I hope, indicated the insidious advances made by this theory of naturalism, even in the mind of a Christian gentleman. Addressing his remarks to a group of educated Jews, Mr. Murphy advanced this following theory, said he, quotations, added to these similarities in faith, Christian and Jew have in common a goal which, in a sense, is larger, more vital than religion itself. That goal is the fulfillment of the ideal of democracy in its every phase, political, social, and economic. It is the task of carrying over into our social and economic order what in religion is called brotherhood. It requires the practical, willing, thoroughgoing, and unselfish devotion of every individual, regardless of creed. Democracy, continues Mr. Murphy, as conceived and expressed in the American Constitution, is something more than a method of government. It is a passionate political faith. It is a faith in the natural capacities and inherent possibilities of the common level of man in his essential worth and dignity. in the scheme of democracy, as in the code of Christianity, all men are on a common level of dignity and importance, unquote. In other words, my friends, democracy is here regarded as more important than religion. And man is regarded as the measure of all things. In other words, this fallacious interpretation of democracy finds no place for poor Christ in the public inn of civilization. According to that theory, Christ's place is in the hidden cave with the animals. Ladies and gentlemen, for thousands of years, possibly, mankind has struggled to make the world safe for real democracy, for spiritual, political, civil, and economic democracy. Success of an undeniable nature attended the efforts of the pioneers from the days of the apostles onward. Eventually, when states divorced themselves from Christ, the tide turned perceptibly. Step by step, the naturalists marched to power. Eventually dawned the French Revolution with its gospel of the rights of man, forgetting to include in its program the rights of God. Humanity, liberty, equality, fraternity. These were its catchwords. These were its promises. Oh, but what of its fruits? Yes, poverty, industrial slavery, war, depression, class hatred, atheistic communism, worldwide turmoil, and finally, Christ once more standing crowned with thorns, holding a reed in his holy hand, awaiting crucifixion. Democracy triumphant. Democracy more important than religion. Man, the measure of all things. Oh, let facts, not rhetoric, answer me these. And I mean not real democracy, but the modern perversion of that word, which endeavors to make it more important than religion, nay, which endeavors to make it the common religion of mankind today. Recollect again the quotation which I read for you from Mr. Murphy's speech. Modern democracy, according to the interpretation of the words of this honorable gentleman delivered in the Yeshiva College speech, becomes not only the modern religion, but greater than religion. Its high priests, greater than the apostles. Its philosophy, sounder than that of the Word made flesh. And its imperialistic, or Bolshevistic, or Naziistic, or political brotherhood, more precious than the spiritual relationship established by the crucified Redeemer. Oh, yes, there stands the King in Pilate's hall, already crowned with thorns, already
holding a scepter, a broken scepter in his hand. A Barabbas already is preferred to him. There he waits after 20 centuries. Waits to be crucified again. Yes, waits for the dissolution of his doctrines in a civilization that regards democracy more important than religion. Rabbi Samuel H. Goldenson, speaking recently before the National Federation of Temple Sisterhoods at the Temple Emmanuel, New York City, asserted that the lack of faith on the part of Jews, yes, the lack of faith on the part of Jews, rather than anti-Semitism, is the most serious problem facing Jewry today. The distinguished rabbi went on to add, quotations, "It is the health of the Jewish mind with which we are concerned. Unfortunately, there are too many sick souls in our midst. That is the problem of Jewry today. Souls in which faith seems to languish." Unquote. Paralleling the rabbi's statement, one might say to Christians and to pseudo-Christians, who imprison Christ's religion, at least within the confines of a church, that the most alarming phenomenon in America today is not the attack on democracy, but the lack of faith in and understanding of Christ's teaching and the operations of the church he established, without which genuine democracy cannot exist. My friends, recognize that the church established by Christ possesses the only divinely conceived program to save individual souls and to renovate the law of the earth in all its social aspects. The only. And this program will not be abandoned, even though its presentation invites persecution. In his famous book entitled The Arians of the Fourth Century, John Henry Cardinal Newman set down an immortal passage which is apropos to what I have just said. Here are his words, quotation. "Strictly speaking, the Christian church, as being a visible society, is necessarily a political power or party. It may be a party triumphant or a party under persecution, but a party it always must be, prior in existence to the civil institutions with which it is surrounded, and from its latent divinity, formidable and influential even to the end of time. The grant of permanency," continues the cardinal, "was made in the beginning, not to the mere doctrine of the gospel, but to the association itself built upon that doctrine, the organization. Thus, the ecclesiastical body is a divinely appointed means towards realizing the great evangelical blessing. Christians depart from their duty or become, in an offensive sense, political, not when they act as members of one community, but when they do so for temporal ends or in an illegal manner. Not when they assume the attitude of a party, but when they split into many. If the primitive believers, continues Newman, did not interfere with the acts of the civil government, it was merely because they had no civil rights enabling them legally to do so. But where they have rights, the case is different. And the existence of a secular spirit is to be ascertained, not by their using these, but their using them for ends short of the ends for which they were given. Doubtless, in criticizing the mode of their exercising them in a particular case, continues the cardinal, differences of opinion may fairly exist, but the principle itself, namely, the duty of using their civil rights, is the service of religion, and is clear. And since there is a popular misconception that Christians, and especially the clergy as such, have no concern in temporal affairs, it is expedient, concludes His Eminence, to take every opportunity of formally denying the position and demanding proof of it. In truth, the church was framed for the express purpose of interfering, or, as the irreligious men will say, meddling with the world. It is the plain duty of its members, so he concludes, not only to associate internally, but also to develop that internal union in an external warfare with the spirit of evil, whether it be in king's courts or among the mixed multitude. And if they can do nothing else, at least Christians can suffer for the truth and remind men of it by inflicting on them the task of persecution. Unquote, Cardinal Newman. Therefore, let us reaffirm these principles. Religion, Christ's religion, and Christ's church are more important than democracy. Democracy itself is not more important than religion, as the words of the new associate judge of the Supreme Court indicate. In its broad interpretation, democracy is identified not only with the Bill of Rights, but with our practice. Not only with the Constitution, which safeguards the rights of minorities, but with its acceptance. Not only with government of the people, by the people, and for the people, but with a people, a Christly people, conscious of their Christly dignity. Not only with institutions of learning, but with teachers skilled in imparting the imperishable truths of Christ. Not only with bountiful fields, well-ordered factories, an abundance of raw materials, but with a Christian plan of economy designed to produce and distribute the wealth of the land. Naturalistic democracy, the mere rule by a majority of people careless of Christ, cannot succeed in bringing these things about. Christian democracy alone can achieve the ends we desire. In a word, Christian democracy is a fruit of the tree upon which it grows, is the tree of life. The immortal Christ, who more than 1900 years ago appeared upon this earth to feed and clothe and shelter us, not only with materialities, but with spiritualities. And without this tree, there can be no fruit. To confirm this statement, question the disappointed and confounded spirits of Rousseau, of Voltaire, of the French revolutionists. Question the deceived spirits of Clemenceau, of Woodrow Wilson, and the signatories of the Peace Treaty of Versailles. Question the troubled hearts of Stalin and Hitler. One answer will they all give, an anguished answer of bitter failure, because all of them ostracized Christ from their council chamber. Therefore, a Christian front, or the Christian church, embracing and professing and practicing in an organized, stabilized manner the doctrines of the Master, is a political party come to perfect and not to destroy, come to safeguard the things that are Caesar's and not dissolve them, but a political party not in the current degraded acceptance of this word. I speak of these things because I have encouraged my friends to join the movement of a Christian front to oppose the attacks leveled against Christianity and its doctrine by the willing and unwilling servants of the Marxian front and the naturalistic front. Recently, a group of laymen, together with a sprinkling of leftist ministers of the gospel, petitioned government officials to investigate my activity. With certain journalists, they join forces. Incidentally, such an investigation will be welcomed with graciousness, particularly since it has been my life's ambition to contribute a share in protecting the Christian heritage of this nation and to defend its constitution from attack, not only against the herods of anti-Christianity, but also against the Judas Iscariots who wear the outward badge of Christ upon their mantles, but within the chalice of whose hearts there are found the Luciferian dregs of non-serviam, I will not serve. And recently I've been honored by a journalistic attack so shallow that one needs no intellectual x-ray to discover its origin. I suspect that those who insidiously and cobra-like framed this attack directly against me and indirectly against the principles which I love, I suspect that through some strange power which they have over those whose hands wield the journalistic pen, I suspect they had a motive in spreading their campaign of vilification. Possibly the motive of the masterminds, merely to rid the world of a troublesome priest. Possibly there was a more sinister reason. Well, to employ others to perform a deed which the real instigators dare not attempt to do themselves is no new technique, especially when political prestige and economic power are involved. I recall what one of the predecessors of the Honorable Frank Murphy spoke on this point before the Supreme Court of the United States in the closing days of the Civil War, while the armies were still in the field. I refer to the Honorable Jeremiah Sullivan Black, who outlined in the legal case entitled Ex Parte Milligan the technique of how those who sit in the seats of the mighty sometimes operate to rid themselves of a troublesome foe. He said, quotation,
Under the old French monarchy, the favorite fashion of it was to write a letter de cachet, signed by the king. And this would consign the party to a loathsome dungeon until he died, forgotten by all the world. In Turkey, the verbal order of the sultan, or of any of his powerful favorites, will cause a man to be tied in a sack and cast into the Bosphorus. Nero accused Peter and Paul of spreading a pestilent superstition, which they called the gospel. He heard the defense in person and sent them to death. Afterwards, he tried the whole Christian church in one body on a charge of setting fire to the city. And he convicted them, though he only knew that they were innocent, though he knew that he himself had committed the crime. Judgment was followed by instant execution. Herod saw fit, for good political reasons, closely affecting the permanence of his reign in Judea, to punish certain possible traitors in Bethlehem by anticipation. This required the death of all the children in that city under 2 years of age. Herod issued his general order, and his provost marshal carried it out with so much alacrity that in one day, the whole land was filled with mourning and lamentation. And Macbeth, understood the whole philosophy of this subject. Macbeth was an unlimited monarch. His power to punish for any offense or for no offense at all was as broad as that which the Attorney General claims for himself and his brother officers under the United States. But Macbeth was more cautious how he used it. He had a dangerous rival from whom he apprehended the most serious peril to the life of his government. The necessity to get rid of him was plain enough, but he could not afford to shock the moral sense of the world by pleading political necessity for a murder. Yes, as in the days of Macbeth, so in our own day, they must mask both the truth and the real assailant from the common eye, lest the public know definitely who are aiming the darts of destruction and for what sinister purposes. For these and many weighty reasons, Macbeth thought it best to commit the execution of his design to a subordinate agency. The commission was organized in Banquo's case, sat upon him that very night. They apprehended him, and at a convenient place beside the road where it was known he would be traveling, they did precisely what the Attorney General says the military officers may do in this country. They took and killed him because their employer at the head of the government wanted it done and paid them for doing it out of the public treasury. Unquote. Probably the greatest attorney general that ever lived in these United States of America. Jeremiah Sullivan Black. Yes, this gentleman spoke those words when the courts of the land, together with those who surrounded the chief executive, were maintaining that all civil courts should be dissolved, that imperial power should be vested in the military and in the chief executive, and that dictatorship should rule supreme with all out of the way who questioned it. But friends, is there a parallel today in the sense that all opponents who disagree, if not with principles,
at least with the practices of this government, should be liquidated in preparation first for Mobilization Day, and then for our entrance into a world war to defend the imperialism of a far-flung gospel of international finance, of anti-Christianity and naturalism. If so, most unfortunately, there are always servants, be they in the editorial rooms or in the pulpit, available to assail those who object to their communism, to their international finance, and to lending aid to the imperialisms abroad. Indeed, history can repeat itself. Hireling clergymen in the past were engaged to prove the divine right of kings and the divine right of defending the status quo of exploitation. Indeed, no abuse of power and no national or international ambition is so flagrant that it will not find its paid defenders and defamers. As the eminent Attorney General Jeremiah Sullivan Black concluded in his appeal before the Supreme Court, here are his words: "Those butcher's dogs that feed upon garbage and fatten upon the offal of the shambles are always ready to bark at whatever interferes with the trade of their master." And so, my friends, so for the butcher dogs in the editorial rooms or in the pulpits, serve ye your masters well, as you bark in vain to stem the resurgent spirit of Christianity and cry down even the least of those who march valiantly in the ranks of the Christian Church for God and country. These words I address to you mainly to record my concept of a Christian front, not to retract any substantial statement I made heretofore or last Sunday. Once more I appeal to the individuals in this audience, be they Catholic or Protestant or Jew, to identify themselves with practical Christianity, the Christian Church, else they will be submerged by the crimson flood of the Marxian Front, or their liberties and their hopes will lie withered under the killing frosts of the materialistic front. Learn from the past. No victory without Christ. And in conclusion, I ask you, ladies and gentlemen, why should a real Christian espouse Nazism, fascism, communism, naturalistic democracy, or imperialism? A real Christian is a philosophy and a leader infinitely superior to those. A philosophy of social life. Why should a member of the Christian Church find companionable fellow travelers in a Rousseau, a Stalin, or a Hitler, when he enjoys the everlasting fellowship of a Paul, an Athanasius, an Augustus, and a John Fisher? Or why should I personally
Prevision, the establishment of peace, prosperity, and happiness through a system of Christless democracy. When I and every Catholic priest know that it cannot be done. When I and every Catholic priest possess the heritage and understanding of Christian democracy, whose principles are as applicable in the 20th as well as in the 3rd century, as applicable in America as they were in ancient Europe. If an individual or a group, therefore, must fear me not, because I praise the principles of the Christian Church, the Church militant. But fear me, yes, fear me, because not hiding behind sacerdotal robes, I hope I possess courage enough to advocate the need of accepting Christian democracy and dare point out the fallacies of Christless democracy. Fear me because the principles that I trust I preach are eternal and cannot die. A Christian front? Most certainly. A front with a philosophy of salvation, of life and of government. A front whose founder and invisible leader is the Son of God. A front whose earthly government is his vicar and his subordinates. A front whose membership is composed of saint and sinner, Gentile and Jew, struggling along to perfection under the flag of the cross and hoping to attain it, not through human leaders, I assure you, but through the grace of him in whom we live and breathe and have our being. A Christian front? Most assuredly. For we recognize the native imperfections of the Stalins, the Hitlers, and all the other civil leaders and groups thereof, who despite their powers, are still like the rest of us, weak, vacillating, sinful men. And we recognize that there is no lasting state, no permanent constitution, no liberty or law or prosperity or peace. Unless, ladies and gentlemen, the cornerstone that was rejected at the birth of naturalism be reset in the temple of our government. Long live Christ the King. Sine me, nihil potestis. Without me, you can do nothing. My friend, if you care to possess a copy of this day's address, as well as of last week's address, together with that 100-page book by the eminent Dennis Fahey, the scholar priest of Ireland, write me a letter this week, and I will be glad to mail you your copy. God bless every one of you.
Thank you.
gentlemen, kindly address your letters for copies of today's address directly to Father Coughlin at Royal Oak, Michigan. And accept our invitation to join us again next Sunday at this same time.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have presented the regular Sunday afternoon program of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan. Statements made and views expressed were those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect the policies of this station. Father Coughlin's address was a presentation on your dial at 1250 kilocycles.